From your world news headquarters on the World Wide Web, it's time for your daily dose of sanity. This is the Maria Heller Show. Maria Heller is a published author, founder of the Universal Wheel, a lifestyle and philosophy based on our interconnectedness to all living things, a Reiki master, and delivers the news with spiritual views. How many intuitive news decoders, animal rights activists, and vegetarian broadcasters are there? Just one. Maria. Maria has provided independent news for a smart audience for over 13 years now on the Maria Heller Show, available at maria.net.
M-E-R-I-A.net.
And now, here is your host, the mouth that roars, Maria Heller.
Good morning, world. Maria here, alive and kicking. How's everybody doing out there? Welcome to the True Science Hour with my excellent co-host, physicist, mathematician, James McCanny. If you're not familiar with James' work, please get over to his website. I have a live link right here that you can click through and absolutely check it out. Every one of his books better than the one before, so you're not going to want to miss it. James, how are you today? We haven't talked in a goodly while.
That's true. I'm very good. Doing very well.
Great. You know, talk about synchronicity. This morning I went outside to have my coffee and I looked up in the sky and we had this sun ray pattern, I'll call it, in the sky of chemtrails. And then you had sent me a video that was posted on Natural News of how they're using these chemtrails and can use these chemtrails to modify our brains, which is also interesting because somebody asked me just last week, you know, do these chemtrails somehow work with HAARP? Because I can see that my mood changes when they're spraying. I get agitated. I feel nervous. What's your take on it, Jim?
Well, there's many, many things. There are so many programs that are involved in this spraying now that it's hard to know what they're spraying in any given time. One thing I've identified myself, I've studied these. I went to Florida because there's very heavy spraying down there. And then I also went up to the Canadian border. They're spraying on the Canadian side and letting it drift over the U.S. And that's partially a global cooling thing where they let these aerosols spread out and then rob the earth of sunlight. And that's why we had partially such a cold summer last summer. These idiots are doing this, believing they're saving the world. But it's hard to say what is in any particular spraying. I saw one on the Canadian side of the Canadian-U.S. border doing a barrel roll. Huh. The point I want to make is these are not commercial jets with people on them. These are jets whose sole purpose, they look just like commercial jets. They're made by Boeing. They're made by whoever, you know, makes commercial jets. But they are not commercial jets. I've tracked them on, because you can go online, see all of the commercial flights that are available in the sky, wherever you are across the entire United States. You can see their path exactly where they are. The spraying is being done from non-commercial jetliners, but they have used commercial jetliners in the past. I don't know if they are using some today, but primarily these are programs. Monsanto has been involved in these for lacing the ground with chemicals. We have this FunVax program, which is started in around 2005. Which sounds like something fun, but it's not. It's fundamentalist vaccine or virus is what it is. It's basically a virus that they believe will take fanatics, fundamentalists, whether they're religious fanatics in the United States or in Arab countries, and turn them into nice people. Mm-hmm. These are the medical reports. The people doing this are nuts.
Absolutely.
I sent you a link. A lot of you people should look at that link.
Oh, absolutely. I'll include that link today also.
Yeah, it's a video in which in 2005, the Department of Defense has a meeting And it's a young, it looks like a young doctor that's working on this. It actually looks like Bill Gates, but I don't believe it is. But talking about how they're modifying or plan to modify, getting support to in aerosols, which are these chemtrail spraying, to modify the behavior of people, to bring them back and so that everybody's normal. Mm. These people are nuts.
Normal according to them.
Right. Well, you know, you wonder why people in the Mideast are crazy. Mm-hmm. If you had your family blown up while you were at a wedding, you know, it might make you a little crazy.
Of course.
You have to look at the source of what's going on. Everybody thinks, well, gee, we're America, we're right. And, you know, there's a lot of history that goes into all of this, why people are crazy or fanatics. But then the other half of it is, well, a lot of these issues, there's a lot of evidence that the shooting in Paris a couple of weeks ago was a set-up false flag event put on by some of our good friends that pulled off 9/11 for the same purpose. They needed a 9/11 event in France to bring the political climate back to the favor of the people in the World Bank and their minions in the government in France who are losing, literally lost the election. There's a lot of movement in a lot of these countries, it's very complicated. I don't want to talk about politics and world politics.
Right. Well, let's get back to this geoengineering. You know, I do know that they've, supposedly released hundreds of thousands of genetically engineered mosquitoes. What do you think about that?
I just got an email from a guy right now in Ontario. People should look this up and see if you can put pressure on the parliament in Ontario right now. Is voting on, I think if the vote is coming up January 25th, to vote to prevent the poisons that they put on plants, the insecticides and other things that are poisoning the bee population in Ontario. Mm-hmm. They have had direct links to the death of the bees, about half of the bee population, to the pesticides being used. Mm-hmm. And the herbicides that are being used in Ontario.
Right.
Many European countries have already banned these, and now the ag companies are putting up a big promotion in Canada to try and block this, as they can do. They convince the people that this is somehow wonderful. And then, of course, there's probably a lot of vote rigging going on and a lot of pressure being put on politicians in Canada to allow Big Agra to keep doing what it's doing.
Right. Well, they also
going out in Canada right now.
Right. Well, you know, they also talk about, you know, some, I think it was in Science Magazine, that by, I don't know what they said, I think it was 2020, that one out of every two children will be born with autism, and they're blaming that on glyphosate, which is part of what Monsanto sprays on our food.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just the bees that are getting affected by this. A lot of people say that this genetically modified engineered food is destroying our cellular DNA.
Right, and the genetic, this is something somebody mentioned the other day just in conversing with a friend, that we've had a history of wars and trauma, human trauma, like million man armies, waves moving across Europe in the World War One, etc. But in World War Two, all of the things going on in many other wars and pestilence, disease, etc. But we've never had, ever in the history of the world, the genetic influence that's going on, the laboratory created foods and animal strains and the genetic modification of human beings themselves. This is the first time in the history of the world that this level of attack on the natural, naturalism, you might call it, just letting nature be, and we're seeing the end results of this. It doesn't work. These people who think, and you know, you've got hundreds and hundreds of these programs, not just one. For every Funvax program, there are 200 more you don't hear about.
Right.
And these people are all active and doing things, and they're out there putting this into the public, spraying, putting it in food, putting it in the populations in water systems, testing people to get results. And nobody knows about this.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, the insanity, the level of insanity out there today is beyond all measure.
Right. Well, I know that, you know, you just said this has never happened or, you know, never a time in human history. But I also know that you've written in depth about the ancient city of Atlantis. And from what I remember studying that, they were pretty much messing around with similar things in Atlantis, and
yeah,
a lot of people said that's really what caused their destruction. What do you think?
Well, the end destruction, according to the legends anyway, is a natural disaster that took Atlantis down, and it sank under the ocean in one night. And one thing I describe in my Atlantis to Tesla, the Colburn Connection book, is the fact that Atlantis had been discovered back in the 90s by the U.S. Navy. They were in searching, and the result of this was a Brazilian physicist who put together a grid work, and I've seen this grid work, very interesting, all of the factors of Atlantis, all the things we know about it, and they would check off, and any one box missing for a place would eliminate that as a possible place for Atlantis. The only place in the world he could come up with that could possibly be Atlantis was in the South China Sea.
Mm-hmm.
And then he realized that the Pillars of Hercules, which were the mariners' entrance into Atlantis, were the two sister volcanoes, Krakatoa, and the other one in the Straits of Java, off of Sumatra. And that the mariners could see these glowing at night for hundreds and hundreds of miles away. And they were the pillars of smoke coming out of the volcanoes, the twin volcanoes.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, one of them has completely blown up since, and Krakatoa has had many eruptions since. It's still partly there from what it was back in the days of Atlantis. But something happened that sent Atlantis under in a single night. And they say when the ships would come in that were trying to find Atlantis, they were caught in these amazing bog areas because Atlantis, there were these amazing grass fields growing up all around it in the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And there was only a single path into it, and they had big mirrors of some kind. There may have been even laser devices, and they could burn the wooden ships out of the water if the enemy came. That's why it was so well protected. But the remains of Atlantis, if you look at the South China Sea, it's very shallow.
Mm-hmm.
It's a vast, flat area, and it still has the remainders of those floating bogs still floating in the water over there.
Huh.
It's one of the highest trafficked shipping areas in the world, and it's one of the most polluted areas in the world because of the amount of oil and other things that are dumped into that area. But the U.S. Navy was in there in the late 90s and beyond, actually salvaging the remnants of Atlantis, bringing it up and bringing it out to secret locations.
Hmm.
And the reason I know about that is one time I was on the internet, and I went in and I was on a military site, and I was looking around. And I had gotten to this by a long URL, and so what I started doing is taking off the end part of the URL, one piece at a time, and I backed into a secure Navy site that was in Northern Australia, and what they were doing was a naval submarine base, and what they were doing was talking about the remnants that they were picking up in the South China Sea from Atlanta. That's what they were doing.
Uh-huh.
So that went into my book, Atlantis to Tesla, the Colburn Connection.
Mm-hmm.
So at any rate, just a little side note on Atlantis.
Well, pretty interesting one. I did want to ask you, what do you think about the Bermuda Triangle?
It's a very real issue. I mean, there's a lot of the planes that have gone down there, other things. And what I believe is it's underneath, it's a very volcanically active area. And that explains the type of things. When the planes, there was a squadron of World War II era planes flying through the area, all of a sudden, a big orange cloud surrounded them. Their compasses went wacky.
Right.
And they all went into the ocean. And so what was going on? They were surrounded by a big cloud of gases that literally came out of the ocean. And the magnetic flux down below them, the movement in the magnetic flows that were going on in the eruption at the seafloor was causing the magnetic fluctuation, so they didn't know where to go or how to fly out of there. Mm. It also explains the ships that go down, vast volumes of gas coming up. What's going to happen? The ship is going to drop down maybe 100 feet even, and before it has time to recover, it's completely engulfed and it just keeps going down. So it explains volcanism. Random volcanism explains that kind of phenomenon.
Mm.
So, yeah, the Bermuda Triangle is something real. It's a very active volcanic area. And that's pretty much, in my book, a closed story on what's going on there. It's a real issue.
Right.
There are other places in the world. There's a region off of the South China Sea in which NASA, whenever they fly over with any of their satellites or the space station or whatever, they shut up all communications. And it's a known area, and it's just the way it is. They can't explain what's going on there.
Uh-huh.
But it's a region in which all communications are affected.
Mm-hmm.
But so there are other places on Earth that have strange anomalies.
Well, I want to share a story with you because it was a strange anomaly that happened to me, James. I took a cruise probably in the 90s, and we crossed the Bermuda Triangle. And when the ship got to the Bermuda Triangle, everything on the ship went dead. Everything. Okay. We were stuck in the Bermuda frickin' Triangle for 24 hours, okay? The captain had no excuse, you know, there was no light, there was no air, there was no water, nothing. The captain actually said it best. He said, "We're dead in the water," okay? Now, I have to tell you. Oh my God, shades of the Titanic. So what they did is encouraged everybody to go to the top deck because there was no air. There was nothing in the ship. And while we're up on the top deck, you know, everybody's getting drunk. You know, I knew to keep my senses about me for God knows a million reasons. And up till that point, I have to tell you, James, I thought everybody that ever talked about UFOs were crackpots, okay? So I was with one of my friends, and I said to her, "Let's go sit on the other end of the ship." You know, it was a full moon. I mean, it was a beautiful night, except we had, you know, all the soot from the smokestacks blowing all over us. And sure enough, I look up, and right around the moon, I'm telling you, if I didn't see it myself, I never would have believed it. I became a believer that night. We're stuck at the Bermuda Triangle, and I counted no less than a dozen UFOs flying in a circular pattern above the ship. I don't need to tell you that I was terrified, James. Terrified. I was like, "Oh my God, go away, I don't believe in you." But when it's in your face, you really can't say that. What was really interesting is the next day when the lights came on, the captain comes on, and he acted like nothing happened the night before. Everybody seemed to have had a personality change on that ship. So I felt like I was in that old movie, Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And I couldn't wait to get off that ship, and I can honestly tell you, I will never go on a cruise again. Can you believe that?
I can. I've been on one cruise, and to Bermuda, in fact, to the Bahamas.
Mm-hmm.
And when we came back up the coast of Florida, it was really big swells in that ship. I mean, when you have something the size of a cruise ship, rocking and reeling back and forth, and realizing that there's a lot of big vanes underneath the ship that keep it stabilized and vertical because they're very high.
Right.
And I thought, you know, I didn't sleep at all the whole night.
I don't blame you. I got my most important stuff and I put it in a fanny pack in case I had to jump overboard. But after seeing so many black and white movies like that, I told my girlfriend, I said, whatever you do, don't go to sleep tonight and don't drink. Don't keep your wits about you. And I mean, everybody on the ship saw it. It wasn't just us. And people were running up to me and they're all, Maria, what do you think that is? Right? I'm like, whoo-wee. I could tell you, but you probably have a bowel movement right here on the deck. So that was it. You know, when people ask me to go on a cruise, I always repeat that story and it ends the conversation.
Right.
So, you know, there are a lot of weird things, but of course, look how many weird things men come up with, you know? I mean, everybody talks about Project Bluebeam. I'm sure you're aware of that. So sometimes you don't know whether it's real or it's a hologram or what.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the amount of strange science that's going on. And this is, when you watch that video that we're talking about, when the people watch this, you watch the matter of factness of how they're talking about simply spraying this into the public and not just putting it in one person. And the guy goes, yeah, we're not going to do brain scans on individual people to see if we should give them this virus or not.
Right.
We're going to just give it to everybody. And he's talking about spraying the old, entire country of Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
He mentions that in the video.
Mm-hmm.
So they're talking about spraying all of these people. And, of course, then they turn and they start doing it in the United States.
Right.
So it's Funvax is the name of the term, F-U-N-V-A-X.
Right.
And it sounds like a circus ride.
Right. What's to stop them from putting in a suicide gene or a race-specific gene or virus? You know, when we send vaccines to, you know, Africa, all of a sudden, whatever we're supposed to be vaccinating them against, they end up getting and they end up with epidemics. And they seem to be smart enough to blame the United States and say, we don't want your vaccines. And yet here in America, everybody lines up for vaccines.
You can get them at the drugstore. You go to Walgreens and they have the first thing in the drawer, they have a big sign, get your vaccine.
Right,
you know,
or a discount.
Free.
You can get it. You can get a discount on your groceries. It's at the grocery store if you get your vaccine. I saw that sign and I was like, oh my God. I remember when I was in Walgreens, the lady said, you know, did you have your flu shot today? And I told her, I said, the only shot I'm interested in is tequila, and that shut her up. Yeah. I mean, I really feel like we're walking amongst one of the worst horror movies we ever made, maybe in the 50s or 60s. And everybody seems to be in a trance, and maybe they've already sprayed everybody.
Well, fluoride is one of the things used that they discovered at pre-World War II, and they were using it in Germany to sedate the population.
Mm-hmm.
But that's where that came from. It's not to clean your teeth. How does drinking fluoride clean your teeth, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of putting a chemical sludge in your teeth, you know, the whole purpose is to dumb people down, just make them kind of like mildly drunk.
Right.
And you can see this. You can see this in the population. They just, you know, go to an airport or a shopping mall and people walking around like
zombies.
You know, like in the ozone layer.
Right. Right. So let me ask you this. Even after seeing that film this morning, because my first little curious brain said, are there people that are naturally immune to this stuff? Because I don't feel like I'm affected by it. You know, you, my guest, you know, people I put on my show, our brains are all functioning right.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, are we immune to this? Is it because we know better? We keep the fluoride out of our water. You know, we eat right. You know, we eat organic. We exercise. You know, we don't poison our mind with their, you know, propaganda films. You know, my mind immediately went off into, you know, obviously some people have a natural immunity to this stuff.
You know, it might be that, they're building an immunity to it over time. And that like alcohol or tobacco or any other modifier, it would take more and more as people become more accustomed to it in their bodies. But it's hard to say.
Right.
But one of the things I talk about also is like the pharmaceuticals in the water supply. Mm-hmm. If you go to the pharmaceutical and there's the thousands and thousands of drugstores all over the country, imagine all of the pharmaceuticals that have been sold, and where does that end up? Because those are chemicals that don't break down. It's not like the they have a half-life or that they break down
right. The
time. So all of that ends up in a water supply, whether it goes through a human body and then goes to the water supply, or whether the people don't use it and they flush it down the toilet, mm-hmm. or whatever. 99.9% of all of the pharmaceuticals, whether they're prescription or non-prescription, not to mention all of the Drano cleaners and everything else people use,
all
that ends up into the underground water supply, and that's what feeds the majority of municipalities. But the pharmaceuticals are a major issue. So what is happening is because people are being doused with these pharmaceuticals in just by drinking water, their bodies' immune systems are breaking down. And so and that's one of the end results, is taking antibiotics or something like that. Mm-hmm. Okay, maybe your body needs a boost now and then.
Right.
But then what happens is the strains of, say, anything from staph infection, you know, that's where all of these strain-resistant viruses and bacteria are coming from, because the human body tries to fight them. They overcome, they learn how to overcome whatever pharmaceutical is battling them, mm-hmm. and they become resistant.
Right.
And so what we've got now are things that they have no clue what to do. It's just like the Monsanto Roundup Ready. Now they have weeds that have developed that are resistant to Roundup, and you can't kill these things with anything. It's the same situation with the human body.
Right.
It becomes resistant the time it learns, and then you have a giant mess. So
yeah, I remember a few months ago, Jim, where I had a report that said they tested municipal water across the country, and most of them tested for a minimum of 26 different pharmaceutical drugs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So now we have the war on drugs. Does that mean we shouldn't drink water? You know,
I mean,
look at the ridiculousness of this world. I'm like, oh, my God. And I don't know if you've seen it. It's just recently posted in, I guess, Journal of Science, about how the oceans are pretty much almost totally dead, and all the life in the ocean, and predicting that the oceans will be, you know, totally dead within another 150 years, which I thought was pretty, you know, pretty optimistic.
Right. Exactly. I was going to say it's not going to take, they always put that time frame out there, especially if it's a government-supported study, because they don't want to shock you into the reality that, hey, it's right now.
Exactly.
The Pacific Ocean, people have done studies on when the tide goes up and down, for example, in the North Pacific, off of Oregon and Vancouver and north up to Alaska, there's a whole infrastructure of species that grow on the rocks. And in studying those, they found that there's like only two of those species left after the Fukushima event.
Mm-hmm.
All of these species have just disappeared.
Right, and a lot of that, including the krill, is what all the other animals in the ocean have to eat. So when you just look at it, and you just know it's just going to it's happening in stages. You know, start small, go big, and sooner or later, human beings are right behind it.
Right.
So, you know, I was reading, I want to remember which one of your books that I was reading. I think I actually took a note on it. It might have been in the Planet X book, okay, where you have only two pages. I was like, wait, I wanted more. On the chapter in the Planet X books, I think it was on page 103, Will Man Survive? I mean, Jim, I have to say, you don't pull any punches, okay? You didn't really hold anything back. And I said, I want to ask his opinion, because everybody says I'm Debbie Downer, okay? So I'm going to push it off on you. Will man survive? What a sentence.
Yeah, it's very simple. It's very simple because what is survival? It's not necessarily what's going on today, but eventually, I mean, this planet has been completely wiped out by celestial events in the past. Mm-hmm. And I'm not talking about an asteroid colliding into Earth. I'm talking about big planet nuclei that are what you would see is a form of a giant comet. But these come close enough to Earth to send it back literally into the cave, into the cave ages or beyond. We've had near complete mass extinctions on this Earth, and modern science doesn't recognize this. We have historical records of Venus being a large comet coming through the solar system, affecting Mars, taking the water and atmosphere off of Mars. And so the point is that all of the stuff we're doing now, there should be one central vein in all of the resource use, et cetera, and that should be to get, if we're really interested in this, if not, then the public is voting against survival of the species because eventually this planet is going to get wiped out. And all of the species along with it. It just about wiped out the human species when the mastodons and the saber-toothed tigers went out. But at any rate, the bottom line is that all of the diversions that are put in front of people are diverting them from the one true thing that we should be doing. And the reason is because in outer space, there's no finances, there's no banks. You would be just living. And if you got the concept that that's how you should live here on Earth, in fact, this is the point of my book, The Diamond Principle, is that man is the way we're going has no hope of survival because you have to get hundreds of thousands of people into space living there as a way of life and able to live long term in outer space. Because if not, because the genetic pool has to be very large. This idea of NASA going to Mars in 20 years with three people is absurd. That's not a space program. That's an anti-space program. And so the whole point here is you can talk about chemtrails, you can talk about Monsanto, all of these things, but they are, in a sense, diversions from the biggest issue. You can talk about global warming. Now right. Congress is going to vote, how absurd, on whether there's global warming from man-made sources or not. How absurd. Congress is going to vote on whether a scientific concept is correct or not. How absurd.
I know. They're not even qualified to tie their own shoes, let alone anything else. James, we're going to take...
But will man survive? No. The way we're heading right now, absolutely not. No chance. Not at all.
Wow.
And we're not teaching the youth what is important. What do they get? Video games and monster cartoons.
Right.
It's so strange. You know, the world is so strange today. Who's making this stuff up? Who puts it on there for mass consumption? And aren't there people with creative things that we can watch for kids' cartoons or other things for adults?
Right.
It's just bizarre. But no, the way we're headed now, there's no chance, and there's no chance of reversing it. In my book, The Diamond Principle, I look back at the Earth from 1,000 years out in the future.
Right.
And basically, the end result is that that's a good point of view. Let's take somebody that's out in outer space, has succeeded, they were a spacefaring society, and they have learned the ways of space and can exist out there. Their planet has been completely destroyed once or twice. They have a history that goes back a million years, not 2,000 years. and they've seen civilizations come and go. They look at this planet and they go, yeah, these these people are going to be dust. There's nothing hope. There's no hope for the human race because they're involved in petty wars. They have all this other riprap going on. Mm-hmm. They're more interested in the local Friday afternoon stock report than understanding what it is to save their species on a long-term basis. Mm-hmm. So, no. Man, it's, you may as well just go drink a beer, watch a football game, because you have to turn around the entire society. It can't be just one segment.
Right. Meanwhile, you can't even get one homeowners association to agree on anything, let alone the whole planet.
Yeah.
I know, it's very disparaging. Jim, we're going to take a short break. When we get back, I got a special question for you, because you did mention Venus a few times. So stay with us. James McCanny and I will be right back.
Wow. One solid hour of commercial-free information thanks to you. The person who wants truth has the integrity and understanding to support it with your donation and subscription. Maria believes people can handle the truth and delivers it tirelessly with those with ears to listen. 14 years on the net. Won't you take a moment right now to commit to a subscription of your choice at www.maria.net. That's M-E-R-I-A.net. Over 1,100 hours of pure education all in one place, 24/7 and all downloadable. Knowledge is power. Sharing that knowledge is wisdom. Together we can change the world and create real hope. Now let's get back to the Maria Heller Show.
Okay, welcome back to the True Science Hour. Might be a little scary, some of the truth you're hearing today. Get over to Jim's website, jmccsci.com. I have a live link here. Just click through. And he's got many books out that I guarantee you will educate and entertain you without question of a doubt. James, before the break, you talked about Venus a few times. One of my listeners had me watch this video on YouTube called Monkey Blood. And the preposition in the movie was that there used to be life on Venus, but they too blew it. And then they show Venus getting cooked, getting too close to the sun, getting cooked, blowing up, whatever, and made some of the photon belt from some of the waste that blew off of it. I don't know, you know, how I feel about that. And I said, oh, I'm going to ask Jim about that. Do you think there was ever life on Venus?
No.
Okay.
No. You know, these stories, that sounds like a good plot for a cheap Hollywood movie.
Mm-hmm.
But the scientific reality, it's very clear that Venus is a young planet. It never had life on it. It came into the solar system as a first-time comet. At least the native population of the world was not aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it probably came into the solar system about 4,000 to 5,000 years ago. It started working its way into the solar system. It had a major encounter with Jupiter, which changed its orbit and put it into the plane of the planets. And that's when it first encountered Mars. Now, Mars, the story was that it had an orbit much closer to Earth. It was a water planet. There was actually travel going on between Earth and Mars was the implication in these stories. And the natives watched in horror as Venus the comet came by and literally sucked the ocean and atmosphere, leaving Mars the dry hulk we see today.
Mm.
Then it had two encounters with Earth about 54 years apart. That we know from the Mayan Popol Vuh, which describes it in great detail, Quetzalcoatl, the plumed serpent of the night sky, whose heart eventually became the planet Venus. And so that's the scenario in my works, explains how this happens, and that's what got me in trouble when I was at Cornell, for example, because I was explaining how big comets can become planets by capture. And by the way, this past week, professional astronomers basically announced that I'm right. They have discovered big planets outside the solar system, mm-hmm. and they said that capture is the mechanism, and that's what I've been saying all along, that capture is the mechanism of the planets. They were not all formed at one time. But essentially, that's what happened with Venus. And so, I mean, it's historically documented. We don't really have history on the other planets, but we do have a history on Venus. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's the short version.
Right.
How so, all of this works is the basis of my comet work, et cetera.
Right.
You've
been proven true on also. Now, when you talk by, right. when you and say that these planets are formed by capture, can you explain that a little more? Because I have a little bit of a hard time understanding that.
Okay, let me do the process in reverse, as many people have a better time understanding this. When we send a satellite out to, let's say, Pluto mm-hmm. or to Saturn, you get a gravitational assist. If you bring that satellite in the right direction, in the right path, near, say, Jupiter, you'll get a gravitational assist, and you pick up a little bit of energy, and actually Jupiter loses that little bit of energy. And it'll slingshot the satellite out to the far reaches of the solar system, and you don't have to take a long propellant by using this technique. Mm-hmm. That same technique works in reverse. Say something is coming in along that same path. Now that process works in reverse. The object loses energy, drops into a lower orbit, and a planet like Jupiter would pick up that little boost of energy, not that you would notice it. Mm-hmm. But now that object has a lower orbit, it's in our solar system, it's been captured. That is and it takes two bodies to do that. You would need the Sun and Jupiter. Mm-hmm. You would need Earth and the Sun, et cetera. That's a two-body problem where the third body comes in, and there's a gravitational energy exchange. And this process is well understood and known. Like I say, we use it in reverse to send satellites out into the far reaches of the solar system.
Right.
So that is capture.
Okay.
It's a gravitational exchange. And then there are other processes. When the comet tail drag affects the comet's motion, in fact, we have many, many examples of comets that have come into the solar system have not interacted with any planets at all and lose a lot of energy because of what I call the tail drag. This is the comet pulling in that tail material, and imagine you're out there moving through space and you're pulling in a lot of material. Well, that causes a backward force on the nucleus of the comet and causes it to slow down in its orbit, and I talk about that in a couple of the chapters in my early papers where the statistics of solar system formation, how all of this works, how all of these principles work together, and how Venus, the large comet, could become the planet we see today in a few thousand years.
Right.
In fact, it took about 600 years for Venus to nestle into its current orbit.
Hmm.
And then it loses its comet tail because it's now in a near circular orbit around the Sun, and it's not cutting through the electrical potential plane of the solar system.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a combination of gravity, electrical conditions, this comet activity where the comet is pulling in material and the effect of that material building up on the comet nucleus. So anyway, that's the process of capture.
Right. Well, and you know, the visual I got with that while you were talking, I don't know about you, but when I was a kid, I remember we used to have glass thermometers, and inside the glass was mercury. And when we had nothing else to play with, which was most of the time, we would break the thermometer and play with the mercury because of the magnetic pull it had. You know, you'd bust it up and then you'd watch it all just kind of magnetize back to itself and become bigger and bigger, all the little pieces. So that was kind of the visual I was getting when you were saying that. And I don't even know why we were allowed to play with mercury when we were kids, but I guess it was, maybe they didn't know it was as dangerous as it is. Who knows? But that makes sense to me because now that they're calling these new planets, Planet X, that also reminded me of one of your books. Don't you have a book with pretty much the same title? Planet X, Comets and Earth Changes?
Planet X, Comets and Earth Changes. And that's where I describe this whole process and what it means to the man on the street. and historically, et cetera, the evidence for this in the past. And I also use a lot of current data. And then in the appendices, I have my three-part comment paper that comes from my original work that I did when I was at Cornell that got me in trouble there with the Astronomy Space Science Department and the Physics Department because I was using the data that was coming in on spacecraft and proving that all of the things they were saying about this, the solar system were incorrect. But at any rate, so now here we are, 2015, professional astronomers for a long time have had this secret program underway to search for planet X-type objects, and they're starting to find them, and the evidence is becoming so overwhelming that they have to actually make announcements about it. And so basically they're saying everything that I have said is correct. They have discovered large planet X-type objects outside the solar system. They don't talk about the orbits. They say these have to be the result of capture, which is a core issue in my theoretical work. And they say that these don't fit the normal mode of solar system formation that they're used to talking about, like a cloud of gas collapsing. Some other process is creating these planets. And I've talked about all of this. This is the core of my work. So professional astronomers have verified the work of James McCanney. And they're making public announcements about this now.
Right. Is it a safe assumption no one's called you to apologize and say, hey, Jim, you were right?
No, I haven't gotten any apologies, especially from a lot of the yo-yos out there who have been claiming all along that I'm wrong and that I'm a nutcase for, and all of this, that my science is all mixed up. No, those people actually should go out and find a new job because they are wrong. They've been wrong all along, and all they've been doing is quoting 30-year-old textbooks that are wrong.
Well, I have to say, I thought about you quite a bit watching the price of oil continue to drop. And I'm sure there's a million reasons, most of it probably political. But I thought about you because I was laughing and said, whatever happened to that whole peak oil scam? You know, you're the only one that actually said, you know, a scientist that actually said that oil continues to regenerate. So what do you feel like when you see gas at the gas station for $2 a gallon? And they're saying it's going to stay this way for quite some time to come. So what happened to all that peak oil?
There was never such a thing as peak oil. That was a myth, and it got a lot of publicity. In the 90s, a guy came, a lot of people come to me and introduce themselves. A lot of them have worked in secure positions, etc. This guy's name was Bill Pollack. He had worked in the secure computing centers of oil companies. As part of what he did was preserve the security of their computer systems. And he told me that we have many, many conversations about all kinds of topics. Anyway, he said in the oil companies, all of a sudden they started laying off all the geologists. And he knew these people. He knew them personally. And so he started asking, he says, what's going on? He said, the response was they had discovered so much oil in the veins and in the, you know, geological rock formations, et cetera. They had discovered so much that we could never in a million years use it all. And so they were laying them off. They didn't need the geologists out there pounding the rocks anymore to discover where the oil was. There were vast, vast reserves, and they knew where they were, and they didn't need these guys anymore, so they were laying them off. So I knew all along that the whole concept of peak oil was just, you know, a lot of smoke in the wind. It had nothing to do at all. I start out my book, The Diamond Principle, with a story. This was right after the BP oil spill. And I said, these people are drilling oil from 18 to 20,000 feet below the surface of the ocean bottom. That's how far down these oil deposits are. Now, how did the dinosaur bones...
James?
...vast reserves? Well, you know, it's ridiculous. The whole history of the Earth as it's being taught is absurd, that somehow it formed it all at one time. Where did these deposits of oil come from? The earth, if it formed that way, would have been too hot. There would be no oil. One of the biggest problems they still have with that concept of where the earth came from is, where did the water come from? Because it had to cool down, and then the water had to come. And then they said, well, it comes from comets, these little comet bombardments. And then they get out to a comet, and there's no water at all on a comet nucleus, even though you see it in the tail. Mm-hmm. And so there again, you come back to my work. My work explains all of this and how these processes work. But one of the main aspects is that hydrocarbons are formed in comet tails. It's part of the, you see them in the comet tail. Mm-hmm. So when Earth passes through a big comet tail, we absorb all of this, and the ancients talk about this. The burning naphtha that came in from the atmosphere, it rained firestones and brimstone and naphtha, mm-hmm. burning as it came in. These hydrocarbons, when it hit the oxygen, and then the very hot rocks that were there, it ignited this, and a lot of it fell all the way to the ground. And that's where the oil comes from. It's literally all over the earth. We have deposits in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean of oil.
Right.
Where did that come from? Where were the fern forests? You know, there are so many contradictions, just basic, simple contradictions in this whole story of the earth. It's just absurd. All of the textbooks keep repeating this garbage.
Right. So you mean the earth is not 6,000 years old?
No. In fact, one can go back if you look at these oil deposits that are down there, those had to be deposited on the surface, the then surface of the earth. Who knows, hundreds of millions of years ago, maybe a billion years ago. So, and what do scientists do today? They look at rocks on the surface of the earth and they go, oh, these are 4.5 billion years old. That must be the age of the solar system. What's on the surface of the earth now has nothing to do, nothing, absolutely nothing at all, with the age of the solar system. Mm-hmm. They do the same thing with so-called moon rocks. They look at them and they go, oh, this is about the age of, and they classify them. Anything on the surface of the moon has absolutely nothing, zero, absolutely nothing to do with the age of the moon. Mm-hmm. Because the moon is down below. They're being peppered constantly by the spray of stuff from outer space. So that what's on the surface has absolutely nothing to do with the age of the moon. So, the absurdity here in standard science, it just boggles the mind. But as long as those professors keep getting a paycheck,
right,
they can keep teaching at universities and life goes on.
Right, just repeating the same old lies, pretty much like everything we've ever been taught since we were kids. Same old lies.
Yeah.
Same old lies, same old myths. Well, James, thanks so much for joining me today. It's been quite the conversation for sure, so I look forward to talking with you again.
Very well, and have a good day, everybody. My best.
You take care. James McCanny, thank you. Check out his work at jmccsci.com. There's a live link right here. And it's just yet another part of our lives that we have all bought into lies and myths that were programmed into our heads from the minute we arrived on this planet. Anyway, tomorrow, Dave McGowan, Send in the Clowns. I'm sure that'll be pretty interesting, so you're going to want to stay tuned. And I want to thank you, each and every one of you, who support my show, and I will see you guys then.
Thank you for listening and supporting The Maria Show. Tell others what you learned today. Knowledge becomes wisdom only when it's shared. Encourage others to subscribe today. www.maria.net. Often imitated, never duplicated. A world of information all in one place. www.maria.net. Always ahead of the curve. Always on your side. Get active or get radioactive. Subscribe today.